This is All Things Political. I'm Joy Cardine, in for Kathleen Dunn today, and we will discuss the issues making news in the presidential race with a national political reporter for Bloomberg Politics, and we'll welcome your questions and views and observations. Our guest is on the ground in Florida, and we will talk about the fight for that state, but we'll also see what our guest has to say about other issues making news on the presidential campaign trail, including the Trump rally that was shut down in Chicago on Friday, and how the Democratic candidates are accusing Trump of inciting violence. So, what issue is on your mind right now? 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. And note that those numbers are different than what you are used to, in that I am broadcasting from Madison, as Kathleen Dunn is out under the weather today. So the number again is 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. Let me welcome our guest. Very happy to have with us Sahil Kapoor, who is national political reporter for Bloomberg Politics. Good afternoon. Got to push the right button in order to hear you, Sahil. Good morning or good afternoon.
Hi. Great to be with you.
So what's the very latest from Florida?
We had a Donald Trump rally last night in Boca Raton, which I attended. It was surprisingly peaceful, no disruptions and no protests throughout, at least during Trump's speech. Today, Marco Rubio is heading south from the northern parts of the state. He's going to do a rally in West Palm Beach, and he's going to do one in Miami later today, trying to keep his presidential hopes afloat, trying to win his home state of Florida, which is looking like a real stretch for him at this stage.
Yeah, he's behind by a lot.
He's behind by roughly 20 points in several recent polls to Donald Trump. He is in second place, but Ted Cruz is not far behind in third place. He's going to have to pull off some sort of miracle and prove all the polls wrong if he wants to, and disastrously wrong if he wants to win his home state.
Yeah. So, how come Marco Rubio is in such trouble in his home state?
There are so many reasons. The main reason is that the strategy that his campaign followed really seems to have not worked. His plan was to slowly gain momentum after not necessarily winning the early states. It was always a tough bet and a bet against history, because no presidential candidate has ever won the nomination after losing Iowa and New Hampshire, at least on the Republican side, in the modern primary contest. So Rubio didn't do well at first. His hope was that he would do second, third place finishes in the early states, and then the field would narrow and that he would do better, and that never happened. So that's a big part of it. Part of it is strategy, but the other part of it is policy. Rubio is associated. He has a very conservative voting record in the Senate, but more than any, you know, as far as Republican voters are concerned, he is associated with the establishment wing of the party, against whom there is a massive populist revolt. That is the story of the Republican primary. And the two people who represent that revolt are Donald Trump and Ted Cruz, and it's no coincidence that they're the ones dominating and winning nearly every state.
Yeah. Talk some about the Latino vote in Florida and why that's not helping Marco Rubio.
Well, the Latino vote down south in Miami-Dade County, for instance, where there are a lot of Cuban-American Republicans, that may, you know, that's likely to work in favor of Marco Rubio. But overall, again, he's not striking a chord with the voters. The fact that, you know, his absence in terms of Senate votes has been in the news has also hurt him in Florida. A lot of people are thinking, you know, he's our home state senator. Why isn't he showing up to work? At first, it didn't seem like those attacks would matter, but now they really seem to have had an impact. And every now and then you also meet, you know, conservative Republican voters who powered him to victory in 2010 in his Senate race, who are still upset, still haven't gotten over the fact that he worked in 2013 to pass a bipartisan immigration bill that would eventually give citizenship to the people who are here illegally now. So it's a variety of reasons, but more than anything else, it just doesn't seem to be his moment. And I think Hispanic Republicans they're overall small in numbers, but he's losing with them as he's losing with pretty much every other demographic.
Marco Rubio going on the attack against Trump in a couple of weeks ago hurt him more than helped him?
It's not clear that did much either way. It is clear that he regrets the way he went after Trump. Firstly, it seems like looking back, it was a little too late, or maybe too much too late, because he had a he had an interesting policy and an issue, a substantive critique of him, of Trump, that he is a con artist who's not proposing conservative ideas, who's trying to swindle the little guy. But he paired that with these sort of personal schoolyard taunts, right? He talked about his small hands. Right. He talked about his spray tan and all this stuff. And a couple of days ago, I was at a rally with him in Hialeah, just outside Miami, and he expressed regret for that. He said, you know, his wife didn't like it. His kids were embarrassed by it, and he regrets using the sort of personal insults. He maintains that Trump deserved to be taken on, and he stands by the substantive things he said about him, but he does regret the way he went after him. And yes, it did give some of his supporters pause. You know, this is a guy who has been one of the most measured, one of the most cautious, I would say, politicians that you would see. And it just struck people as out of character. So it certainly raised some eyebrows, but I haven't detected a major shift in the polls. I wouldn't necessarily argue that, you know, has hurt him in the polls more than other things.
Yeah, but he did have he had a disastrous week last week, too.
Right. Right. I mean, this is where it all came crashing down, because his strategy, his campaign has been very opaque about its strategy, and then it had a very bad Super Tuesday, and it had an even worse showing in the March 5th, and it got even worse in the March 8th contest. So his campaign is in a bit of a downward spiral. Wow. It's a free fall, because the magic of his campaign was supposed to be that he's a winner, right? He's the one he's the Republican who's best positioned to defeat Hillary Clinton. He's the one who's best positioned to unite the party. And then he kept losing states, and I think that magic sort of faded. So that's what he's dealing with now. He's trying to recapture it here.
And now, while Marco Rubio struggles in his own home state, his campaign is urging his supporters in Ohio to vote for John Kasich.
That's right. This is a very unusual thing to do, right, for a campaign, for a candidate who's still in the race and at least says he intends to win the nomination, to tell his supporters somewhere else, go vote for another candidate. It's pretty remarkable. But, you know, the strategy behind it is pretty much what many mainstream and establishment Republicans, many Republican elites want to do. They realize that Donald Trump, there's probably nobody who's going to overtake Donald Trump in terms of delegates right now. He's far ahead and he's best positioned in the states that come. So the only way to defeat him, according to many Republicans now, is to defeat him at the convention, is to deny him the magic number of 1,237 delegates, which is a majority, to win the nomination outright, and to challenge him at the convention. Because the way that works is, on the first ballot, delegates are pledged to you based on what states you won and how much you won in those states. But after the first ballot, and the second or third or ballots beyond that, more and more delegates are freed up. So the theory is, you prevent him from getting the delegates, you stop him at the convention, and in order to do that, you have to make sure he doesn't win these big states like Ohio, for instance, where Rubio is not competitive, but John Kasich, the governor of that state, is very competitive. He's leading Donald Trump narrowly in some polls. He's behind narrowly in others. And Kasich has the best chance of preventing Donald Trump from winning those 66 delegates. It's winner take all. So that's the theory of what Rubio is doing. And I think it's showing some results. I think there was a poll out today that showed in the last week Rubio has dropped 6 points in Ohio, Kasich has gained 6 points in Ohio, and Donald Trump is flat, according to the same poll. So it sounds like some Rubio supporters are heeding his call.
Oh. So how did Donald Trump's rally go last night in Florida?
You know, it was remarkably peaceful. Like I said, no disruptions. He was the same person he always is. He was edgy. He was angry. He talked about how the country is run by stupid and incompetent people, that he's going to get it back on track. So it was a pretty standard Trump rally, but unusual in that it was interruption-free.
Oh, yeah, so he wasn't able to accuse Bernie Sanders of sending any protesters over there.
Exactly. You know, he even paused at one point in the rally. It's almost like he planned, he expected there to be protests, which is probably reasonable, and planned out what he was going to say. At one point, he paused in the rally and he said, "Is there any protesters here? Anybody want to protest? Come on, speak up now." It was like he was taunting them, and it never happened.
Well, we'll talk more about the rally that wasn't so peaceful for Donald Trump on Friday in Chicago in just a moment. But how is the Democratic race in Florida looking?
Hillary Clinton has a huge advantage in Florida. She's looking very good to win the state, and this is the sort of state that she has always been poised to win. A Quinnipiac poll shows her up by a pretty huge margin. She has 60%, and Bernie Sanders has 34%. This is exactly the kind of state that she should win and needs to win if her strategy is to work at all, because it's a large state. It has a diverse population, not sort of a small white state like Iowa and New Hampshire, where Bernie Sanders tends to do well. So, you know, the theory is Hillary Clinton has to do well in a state like this with lots of minority voters.
We just heard a news story in NPR News just before we started that Hillary Clinton was at risk of losing her home state of Illinois tomorrow. That's got to be troubling to the Clinton campaign.
Yeah, the poll, there's not a whole lot of good polling in Illinois at this point, so it's hard to know what's going to happen. But the industrial Midwest is a tough place for Hillary Clinton. Bernie Sanders has lots of strength there, and the main reason is in Ohio and to an extent in Illinois as well, a lot of places have been hollowed out because of the manufacturing job losses. So Bernie Sanders is very strong on that. He's been saying for decades that the trade deals like NAFTA and now the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which many view as sort of in the same category, although the White House disputes that, many voters in those states have been hurt by trade deals like that. And Bernie Sanders has been railing against them for many, many years. And he has a stronger argument to make on that front, because Hillary Clinton has been supportive of, at least in rhetoric, of trade deals like the Trans-Pacific Partnership. She doesn't have a clear record against them that Sanders does. So that is a key issue that is powering him in the industrial Midwest. And that, I think, that was a critical issue that helped him win Michigan by, which was a massive upset victory for him.
And presumably that would help him in Ohio as well.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. And are you aware of the polling in Ohio? Is it the same thing?
Sure. So you mentioned Illinois. I should have added a poll that came out yesterday by CBS showed Sanders up by 2 points in Illinois. So you're correct that that he could potentially win that state. In Ohio, let me see here. The latest poll, there was an NBC Wall Street Journal poll out yesterday that showed Clinton up by 20 points in Ohio, but that doesn't quite track with other polls that show.
And of course, she was ahead by double digits in Michigan too.
Exactly, and she's up by another poll that came out just today by Quinnipiac in Ohio shows Clinton up by just 5 points. So it's expected to be a close race in Ohio.
So Hillary Clinton was pleading with her supporters to get out and vote in Illinois. Was this, and she said, we need this so that we can have the wind at our backs after tomorrow. Do you have any sense as to whether on the Democratic side first, right, for both sides, is tomorrow going to decide essentially who the nominees are going to be?
It very well could. If Donald Trump wins Florida, he is pretty much unstoppable. If he wins Florida and Ohio, it looks likely that he could win outright the number of delegates and prevent any kind of drama of a contested convention. So, and those two states are also critical in terms of whether Marco Rubio, home state Florida, and John Kasich, home state Ohio, are going to stay in the race. If they don't win their home state, Kasich has said outright that he would drop out. And with Rubio, it's sort of expected because there's no real path for him. So on the Republican side, that's certainly true. I think it's true in a different way on the Democratic side, because Bernie Sanders has to show his last bastion of great strength outside sort of rural caucus states is the industrial Midwest, and he has to win places like Ohio. I think he has to do very well in Illinois if he wants to prove that he still has a path to the nomination, because not only is Hillary Clinton ahead, she dominated the South, which gave her a lead of several hundred delegates, and the only way, and she's also way ahead in terms of superdelegates. So the only way that Bernie Sanders can theoretically catch up is if he shows real strength in some parts of the country, and this is the part of the country where he has to show strength. He did in Michigan. We'll see what happens.
Sahil Kapoor is the national political reporter for Bloomberg Politics, and he is our guest for this edition of All Things Political, talking with us about the latest issues making news in the presidential race. He is covering the presidential race in Florida right now. He's in Miami. And we welcome your thoughts and questions. When we come back from break, we will talk about the Trump rally that was shut down in Chicago, and we'll talk talk about what the Democratic candidates for president had to say about that. And we'll welcome your thoughts or questions for our guest of any political sort at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. I'm Joy Cardine in for Kathleen Dunn, and this is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine in for Kathleen Dunn for this edition of All Things Political. We are talking about the big primary elections coming up tomorrow. We're talking about how the presidential race is shaping up and welcoming your questions, your thoughts, your observations. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Our guest is Sahil Kapoor, who is national political reporter for Bloomberg Politics. I wanted to talk a little bit about Donald Trump's rally in Chicago that was shut down over protester violence. The candidates at a town hall meeting, the Democratic candidates for president at a town hall meeting last night talked about this. Bernie Sanders called Donald Trump a pathological liar, among other things. Trump was accusing Bernie Sanders of sending his supporters to his rallies. What evidence of this is there, Sahil?
Evidence that Bernie Sanders is sending his supporters to Trump rallies? There isn't any, and I don't think the Trump campaign has produced any. What we do know is that some of those protesters happen to be supporters of Bernie Sanders, right? So that doesn't mean the campaign is necessarily sending them. It means that these people don't like Trump, they have a beef with him, and they want to express it, and they happen to be supporting Bernie Sanders. Now, the Trump campaign has interpreted that and is spinning that to say that Bernie Sanders is inciting these people and sending them. There's simply no evidence of that, and Bernie Sanders came back very strongly, as you mentioned, 2 days ago, called him a pathological liar, said his campaign had nothing to do with the protests, said he appreciates the fact that there happen to be people that support him, but that, you know, his campaign, this is not about what his campaign is doing, this is about Trump's campaign inciting violence with his words and actions, you know, that have encouraged this stuff on the part of other people. That's what Bernie Sanders has said.
And let's take a listen to Hillary Clinton, who was accusing Trump of committing political arson. Here's a clip.
Clearly, you know, people who engage in protest should follow civil disobedience principles and should be peaceful, should be nonviolent. But I do think that, as I said the other day, what Trump has done is like a case of political arson. You know, he has lit the fire and then he throws his hands up and claims that he shouldn't be held responsible, and he should be held responsible.
What's your response to that, Sahil?
It's a very strong denunciation from Hillary Clinton. I think it energizes her supporters in a certain way, and Bernie Sanders' denunciation energizes his supporters in a way. But it's also a very important moment in American politics that we're seeing this sort of thing. I've covered many of the campaigns this cycle, and I've covered campaigns in the past. I've never seen or heard of anything like this, where there's regular protests and there's regular clashes and tensions and violence and punches thrown and stuff at rallies. This is very unique to Trump. There's no other candidate in this race for whom this is a problem. But the bigger issue is that Trump, you know, you mentioned that he lit a fire. A lot of people have said this, and there's certainly an argument here. I think the fire has been lit. The fire was already lit. What Trump did was just douse a bunch of gasoline on it. For the last 7 years, the Republican Party has been telling its base two things. Number one, it's been telling its base that President Obama is ruining the country, destroying all the things you love about it. And number two, don't get too worked up about it. Along comes Trump and says, hell yeah, I'm worked up, and you should be too. And that's a big part of why we're seeing what we're seeing. And he backs that up by saying things like, you know, in the old days, protesters would be carried out in a stretcher, or we could get rough with them, and we're too politically correct now. And he said things to the effect of, if you go after a protester, I'll pay you and get in trouble with the law, I'll pay your legal fees. These have been interpreted not only by Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, but by many moderate Republicans too, and mainstream Republican Party leaders, as inciting violence. So, you know, this fire goes back a ways, but I think this, Trump is just taking it to a new level.
Let's take a call from Dave in Menominee. Hi, Dave.
Hi, thanks. Yes, your guess is exactly right. The fire has been lit by the right-wing media. And Republicans also extremely divided this country. And they want to, of course, not take responsibility for it. And they divided the country under Bush. We heard things like Paul Ryan calling people, you're either a taker or a maker. That the language that they used was always divisive. Scott Walker said he was going to use divide and conquer as a strategy. And when the Tea Party came in 2010, they gutted out the moderates out of Congress. If you were a moderate Republican, you got Tea Partied and you're gone. And if you were a moderate Democrat, you were Tea Partied and you're gone, leaving a big chasm in the middle, along with the 65,000 foundries, mills, and factories of middle-class earning people whose jobs were shipped away, leaving another chasm of finance. You know, the middle class has been gutted, and there is a big divide, and Republicans created it, have exasperated it, and don't want to take responsibility for it.
Well, Dave, thanks very much for the call, and Sahil, I respond in general to Dave's comments, but aren't many of Trump's supporters, some of these middle class who feel, you know, an economic malaise and that their jobs have gone overseas and the like?
Yeah, absolutely, Joy. It's a multi-front issue. Part of it is the economic anxiety that people feel because middle incomes have stagnated now for about three decades, maybe longer, since I think going all the way back to the Reagan era. The gains and the economic gains have gone disproportionately to the top 1%. Ironically, in some cases, disproportionately to the top 0.01%. It's been very lopsided in terms of who's benefited, and there is a lot of anger there. And there's a lot of anger on the Republican side. There's certainly a lot of anger on the Democratic side as well. This is Bernie Sanders' core message, and it's resonating in a way that nobody really thought it would because we haven't seen a candidate hit these themes so forcefully and so aggressively and in a credible way, because he's been saying this all the way since 1990 when nobody was talking about income inequality. Now even Republicans are talking about it. The other thing is more complicated. It's demographic. The country is changing in profound ways, and it's on its way by 2050 or maybe before to becoming a minority-majority country. That means whites will no longer be a majority of Americans, and that is creating a lot of tensions as well. Some people, you know, there are parts of the country that aren't particularly thrilled about that, and I think the election of President Obama as the first African-American president emphasized that paradigm shift. Mm-hmm. So that's also a big part of what's driving the tensions and the anger in the political process, in the political scene right now.
Is Donald Trump the candidate for the Tea Party?
To an extent, the Tea Party was always divided between, or the Tea Party was made up of two different segments, I'll put it this way, intellectual conservatives, you know, who believe in traditional limited government and low taxes and deregulation and so forth, but it also had a very strong nativist faction. Right, the people who didn't like, who wanted immigration to be reduced, who believed that white Americans were getting the short end of the stick, and that a lot of minorities were kind of benefiting from government largesse in a way. So Donald Trump certainly represents that nativist faction that has been important to the Tea Party, but he doesn't so much represent the intellectual conservative movement, right? Because he's not for free trade; he's attacking free trade. He's not for cutting entitlements like Medicare and Social Security. He's saying we need to protect those. And he's just generally, his critique of government is not that it's too big or too liberal. It's that it's too stupid and run by incompetent people, and all you have to do is put a smart, competent person like him in charge, and things will be fine. So I would say he represents a part of what the Tea Party is, but certainly not mm-hmm. the whole thing.
Next we go to Ed in West Dallas. Hello, Ed.
Good afternoon, Joy.
Morning. Go ahead, Ed.
Well, it was a dark and stormy night for Mr. Trump on Friday, and it's just going to continue as we head down the road, especially with those of us in organized labor. nobody from the organized press can even ask Mr. Trump the real basic question as to why he doesn't have the union label on his signs and on his material. Here's a man who says he can self-finance his campaign, and he can't even do the one thing that all major candidates need to do to pull in the votes of organized labor, and that's to put the union bug on it. He is, just has a as all Republicans do, has this tremendous anger and hatred of organized labor. Republicans cannot win without us. We're still angry from Act 10 and Right to Work. You should see the signs in Ohio about Right to Work. I was there yesterday, and this is going to be following. It doesn't make any difference if it's Trump or even worse, Cruz. This divide is palpable and real, and it's going to be following any Republican candidate to the very end of the election in November.
Sahil? Are you there, Sahil?
Ready?
Oh, no, for some reason, we couldn't hear you. Now we can.
Okay, great. No, I think your caller is exactly right that Republicans have pretty much, I think in a way, written off the organized, written off organized labor from Scott Walker's reforms in Wisconsin. And I think overall, it's just part of their rhetoric. They don't view organized labor as a friend to the middle class, even though, you know, that's the whole point of organized labor. That's the whole point of the movement. The Republican candidates have essentially started talking about organized labor as a factional, a special interest group that essentially exists in their view to enrich union bosses, quote unquote. So I don't think this is a segment of the American population that they are trying very hard to win over. I think instead they're trying to turn working class Americans against unions by somehow arguing that unions oppose middle class interests. Obviously, that's a controversial proposition at best, and you have Democrats on the other side who are competing heavily for the union vote. And the union vote used to be splintered between the parties. There wasn't this clear divide that we're seeing now. And as we're seeing on so many issues, unions have become a very clear, stark partisan issue.
Jane on email believes the protesters were in Bernie's camp and says the following. I'm sure that more of these paid protesters and undemocratic supporters of Bernie will regroup and attempt to shut down more free speech in the future. It is quite sad that a certain group of people are so afraid of words that they refuse to allow people who dare to disagree with them to speak. Then she goes on to say that she can only imagine what the media would be saying if Trump supporters or conservatives in general would routinely show up at Bernie and Hillary rallies and try to shut them down. You have a comment on that, Sahil? Yeah, I'm not sure why we have a problem with your phone line. Are you there, Sahil? Well, why don't we check in to see if for some reason the line dropped, and we will remind you that we are talking about all things political, and you can join in with your thoughts, your observations of issues making news on the presidential campaign trail. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. As we try to make reestablish contact with our guest, let me take another call from Reed in Clintonville. Hi, Reed.
Yes, good afternoon. Well, I hope you can get your guest back. But in the meantime, I'd like to make just a couple of issues. The first one, in regard to Gene's comment about free speech, we have seen with the Tea Party and its inception in about 2010, all the way up right through today, Tea Party members and radical right-wing Republican individuals who have shouted down candidates right across our country. And there is video evidence of this aplenty, should Gene wish to actually access it. The other two issues that I'd like to speak to are, first, Donald Trump talks about no jobs here in America. Americans jobs are not being created for them. However, he's created a lot of jobs, but they have all been in China. And as an example, I remember seeing someone on a late night show. There was a YouTube clip, I believe it was, where they turned over one of his ties and it said "Made in China," as are his suits, and I suspect many other items that he markets or hawks. Everything except perhaps his steaks, but maybe those also. And the last issue is tonight, I believe, that he and Chris Christie are going to sit down. They're going to try to look presidential and vice presidential, Chris Christie being one of a handful of maybe three people who are Republicans who are supporting him at this time. And Christie looking for that vice presidential slot. And they're going to sit down, and Chris Christie will, if people watch, and actually evaluate what's being said. Chris Christie, I'm sure, will provide him with a lot of softball questions and work his magic trying to make Donald Trump look presidential.
I got it, Reed. Thanks very much. We are still trying to make a contact with our guest, and we have done so. So we will. I'll ask him to comment on that right now. Sahil Kapoor is a national political reporter for Bloomberg and Bloomberg Politics, and he is our guest for this edition of All Things Political. Sahil, our last caller just said that there's going to be some sort of a campaign event tonight where Chris Christie is sitting down with Donald Trump. At least our caller thought so, and said that this is Chris Christie auditioning to be vice president. What do you say to that?
You know, it's certainly plausible. Chris Christie wanted to be president. He ran. His campaign never really got off the ground. He put all his chips in New Hampshire, and that failed. So Chris Christie still has a couple of years to be governor. After that, surely, if there's a Republican administration, he'd love a spot in it. He denies that he is angling to be vice president right now, and it's hard to know what exactly is going on in his mind, but this is clearly an ambitious person, you know, who has ambitions beyond being the governor of New Jersey. Can I just add, can I go back to what I was saying about your previous caller who mentioned the emailer who mentioned Sanders and Trump? Firstly, we haven't seen evidence that that Sanders is paying people or sending people to go to Trump's rallies. These are certainly some of his supporters. So that's notable. It is true that, you know, of course, if there was evidence of that, I think the media would be making a big stir of it, just as we would be making a big stir of it if it was the other way around, if Trump was sending his supporters to Bernie Sanders' rallies to disrupt them. Ironically, Trump did send a tweet, I think it was yesterday or the day before, threatening to do exactly that. It was something on the lines of, "Be careful, Bernie. If you keep doing this, I'll send my supporters to your rallies as well." So there is a bit of that back and forth going on. It's just not, you know, there's just no evidence that I've seen. Maybe others have that I've seen, but there's no clear evidence that one campaign or the other is sending supporters to another's rally to disrupt.
Sahil Kapoor is national political reporter for Bloomberg Politics, and we will take more of your calls for him at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine, in for Kathleen Dunn. This is All Things Political on the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. In for Kathleen Dunn, who is out today. We hope she feels better soon. We are talking with Sahil Kapoor, who is the national political reporter for Bloomberg Politics. We are talking about the 2016 presidential race, certainly heating up. Big primary day tomorrow with primaries in Ohio and Florida and Illinois. Some are saying that tomorrow's vote may shake out the final candidates from the two parties. What do you think? What questions do you have? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. We'll move past the rally protests for a moment. Carl in Madison has been waiting. Hi, Carl.
Yes, hello. Joe, I'm a big fan of yours as I am of Kathleen's, and I'm becoming a fan of Mr. Kapoor. I think this is a very reasoned analysis. I want to switch from the political landscape to how it connects to the actual landscape. Bernie Sanders, at a recent rally in Minneapolis, spoke on the issue of tar sands oil pipelines and their relation to climate change. And this has been an issue Hillary Clinton has been very late to, although her perspective is certainly far more environmentally sound than anyone on the Republican side. But Sanders, I have a quote from the rally. He states, President Obama said that when his administration was reviewing the Keystone, he wouldn't approve it if it made climate and our planet more dangerous. He wouldn't approve it if he could make the point that the emissions from the entire project would add to climate change. Those are exactly the same standards we need to apply, he says, going on to state, that's what I would do as president. The bottom line for me, he states, is I've got 4 kids and 7 grandchildren, and our moral responsibility is to make sure that we leave this planet in a way that is healthy and habitable for future generations. And so I think that one of the things that's going forward in Wisconsin, depending on how things shake out in this Super Tuesday, too, is we may become a really critical state in Bernie Sanders' campaign hopes. And I think this is an issue where there's a clear difference between the candidates, and with the last 5 months being all of them the hottest months ever recorded, I think this is an issue that underlies every other.
Sahil?
Well, firstly, thanks for your kind words. I think the difference between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton on the issue of the Keystone Pipeline is absolutely, you know, is absolutely stark. And he came out early and forcefully against it. She came out pretty late against it, after kind of holding her tongue for a long time. So, for voters prioritize that issue above. As a very important issue, I think the choice is fairly clear there. But at the same time, the overall difference between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders on climate change is not here. In other words, you're not going to be getting it's not going to be night and day. Either of them versus any other Republican candidates is going to be night and day. But they both want to continue President Obama's Clean Power Plan, the executive actions he took, which are now held up in court to regulate coal-fired power plants and to reduce emissions.
Oh, I think we're going to have the same problem. Now, we lost our guest. It sounded like that was a cell phone that dropped off. So we're going to have to reestablish contact again with Sahil Kapoor, who has great analysis and great reporting going on the presidential race, but the phone lines that we have for him are not the greatest. So 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. While we have them again, so I think that we pretty much got you concluding your remarks for Carl, or did you have anything further, Sahil?
Right, no, that's pretty much it. The divide between the Democrats and Republicans is extremely stark. Within the two parties, it's relatively minor. We'll leave it at that.
Let's go to Sivu in Manitowoc next. Hello, Sivu.
Oh, hi. Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a long-term listener. I love listening to you and Kathleen Dunn. And my question is, Mr. Trump, I read somewhere that he's not for raising the minimum wage. And why are these people supporting him?
So why do people support Donald Trump?
That's an excellent question. Well, firstly, your caller is right. He does not support raising the minimum wage. He's in line with every other Republican candidate on this front. They argue that raising the minimum wage would harm businesses and cost jobs and force them to fire people because they can't pay the extra costs. The reason people are supporting him is, I guess I could go on for an entire hour about that, but the short version is there's a tremendous amount of anger at not only the political system but at the Republican Party. He's running on a campaign of, I want to blow up the political establishment. I don't want to install something very different and very new that is more likely to help average workers. He supports reducing immigration levels. He opposes free trade deals. And he supports things like keeping Social Security and Medicare. These are all breaks from the current Republican establishment agenda, and he's managed to convince them that he's going to fight on their side. And I think one of your previous callers mentioned that he manufactures his product, you know, his personal product in Mexico and China. The really interesting thing here is that he doesn't deny that, right? He accepts that his attitude there is that I know the political system. I've gamed the political system. I've exploited it and used it for my benefit. And now I want to change the system and I want to fight against it. So it's an interesting, it's a novel argument, but it seems to be working with his supporters.
Now, we talked earlier about Marco Rubio's campaign encouraging his supporters in Ohio to vote for John Kasich. We had a caller who we just who just dropped off who wanted to bring up that former Wisconsin Governor Tommy Thompson, former Health and Human Services Secretary and U.S. Presidential candidate Tommy Thompson, was just today or yesterday came out in support of John Kasich. And I think it was Speaker John Boehner endorsed John Kasich over the weekend. I mean,
right.
Is any of this going to do John Kasich much good?
I don't know. I don't know how many voters there are that are taking their cues from people like John Boehner and Tommy Thompson at this point. But I think what's clear is that of the four remaining Republican candidates, John Kasich is the only one who represents old school Republicans, right? The sort of Republican that has to win nominations. They like governors. They like people who have been around for a long time and who are experienced. John Kasich has been, he was a chairman of the Budget Committee, as he likes to remind us all, in the 1990s, and he's worked in various aspects of government. It's a huge contrast from other Republican candidates. You have Trump, who has never run a political campaign before, who is a total, rookie at this, apparently a pretty good one, but he hasn't done it before. You have Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz, who are first-term senators. The Republican Party really doesn't nominate people like those three, and John Kasich sort of fits the mold. So you have old-school Republicans like Thompson and Boehner who look at him and say, yeah, he's kind of, he's our guy. He's someone who represents what we're all about.
Well, we talked a little bit earlier about Bernie Sanders saying that Trump is a pathological liar. He also was asked at the town hall about how could the Democrats or can the Democrats stop Donald Trump? And here's what Bernie Sanders had to say about that.
The American people are not going to elect a president who is insulting Mexicans, Muslims, women, veterans, insulting virtually everybody who is not quite like Donald Trump. Thank God most people are not quite like Donald Trump.
So I guess I'm wondering if, I don't know, will the American people, I mean, can Democrats be so confident in saying that the American people will not elect Donald Trump?
I think they're a little more confident than they should be about this. A lot of people who are saying that also wrote him off in the primary, thought he'd never get off the ground. But I have noticed a shift among Democratic strategists recently who are starting to realize that, Trump, for all his inflammatory rhetoric, and for all, for all his poor and dismal ratings with minority groups and especially Hispanics, might be a more formidable force than we thought. Because firstly, he's proven himself to be a nimble politician in that he can change pretty dramatically his past views without paying a serious price for it. It's a jury's still out on whether he can pull that off in a general election. But his path would be to remake the map, and he's the sort of unconventional candidate who might be able to do that. His path would be not so much the traditional swing states like Florida, Colorado, Nevada, which have a lot of minority voters. His path would be in the industrial Midwest, where his anger at free trade deals and things like that could go a long way, and his path would be to win Midwestern states like Ohio, Indiana, perhaps Wisconsin, perhaps Pennsylvania. That's a stretch because Republicans haven't done that. The Republicans haven't won Pennsylvania and Wisconsin for several decades now, but the theory behind a Trump candidacy is that he could upend that that traditional map. There's still, I think, Democrats are overall pretty confident that they will be able to beat him, given the fact that the electoral math overall favors them. But I have noticed a shift lately. They're not quite as confident as they used to be,
for good reason. Chris in Wisconsin Dells wonders, why would any Latinos in Florida, I guess, or elsewhere, support Donald Trump after his derogatory comments?
That's a great question. I don't fully know the extent to which he's offended Hispanic Republicans in places like Florida. But the bottom line is they're voting for him for the same reason that, other demographic groups are voting for him. They like the fact that he, they see in him an authentic politician who's not a typical politician, who is not in it simply for his own personal ambitions. I was talking to a woman last night who hadn't voted at his Boca Raton rally, who hadn't voted for 30 years. She's 80 years old. She hadn't voted for 30 years because she thinks politicians are all the same. But in her view, Donald Trump is an authentic politician because he's, accomplished all that he needs. He's in his late 60s now. He could be retired if he wants to. And she sees in him someone who simply wants to do, who simply wants to do good for the country. So for the same reason that white Republicans vote him.
I'm just going to hope against hope that Sahil is still there and it's just a momentary dropout. But I don't think so. I still have the fader up. So one more time, we will try to reestablish contact, and then we will take more of your calls, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Let me go to Susan in West Dallas now. Hi, Susan.
Hi. I read an interesting article this morning on Huffington Post, and it was written by Joe Scarborough. And his idea was that this entire brouhaha of Trump's had been planned in advance. He said, first of all, the location was suspect because it's a very multicultural university setting. It's just not really his audience. And he thought that by having to back out, he would be able to dominate the news, which he did, for the entire time since then. And that, Scarborough said that everything that Trump does is quite calculated.
Yeah, interesting. So we have Sahil back again, and you may not have heard all of that, but our caller said the Huffington Post did an article today on Joe Scarborough, former Republican Congressman Joe Scarborough's contention that this Trump rally, protest, violence, shutdown was all pre-planned, in part because it was set up at a multicultural university venue, which isn't exactly Trump's typical venue and the like. Any thoughts on that, Sahil?
Well, I haven't seen evidence of that, so I wouldn't want to speculate on that beyond saying that we haven't seen concrete proof of it. But I would say that, for Trump to plan a campaign rally in Chicago, which is the president's hometown, which is a very progressive city, which has a lot of minority voters who are overwhelmingly Democrats, of course he should have expected, he should have expected a sort of backlash. I don't know that he expected it to be quite this severe and to the point where he had to shut it down. But this is also the president's hometown, and Donald Trump, remember, his political roots back in 2011 in the Republican Party were whether the president is an American citizen, whether his birth certificate is authentic, and whether he was really born in the United States and therefore eligible. So, Chicago was sort of the perfect storm of everything you would expect to come together and to a backlash against Donald Trump. Yeah. I'll say that much.
Well, we just have a couple of minutes to go. What are you going to be watching for, especially in Florida, where you are right now?
Number one, the turnout in Miami-Dade County, whether Marco Rubio can bring out enough of his supporters in the southern part of the state where he's strong. But again, I wouldn't, unless there's some sort of miracle, and that could potentially be it, but I wouldn't count it, unless there's some sort of miracle, Trump will probably walk away with Florida. The more interesting thing will be Ohio. Can John Kasich pull out a win? And after that, can he experience a sort of boost that will carry him into other states with a lot of moderate Republicans, blue and purple states like Pennsylvania, New Jersey, California? Can John Kasich become a serious competitor? Because so far he has not been.
Yeah, and with our final minute, if somehow this it turns into a brokered convention, what happens there, do you think?
Oh, it would be absolute chaos. It would shatter the party. Just think about it. This entire Republican primary has been about a populist uprising against the establishment. If the establishment turns around at the last minute and says, oh, forget about that, we're not going to let the candidate you voted for win, there's going to be hell to pay, and it's I don't see how the Republican Party will survive in one piece.
And you don't see House Speaker Paul Ryan, Wisconsin Congressman Paul Ryan, stepping in to be the savior, do you?
He's ruled that out multiple times, and I take his word on it.
Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Sahil Kapoor is a national political reporter for Bloomberg Politics, talking with us from Florida, where he's covering the presidential race. Well, thanks to KP Whaley for producing and directing this hour. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. I'm Joy Cardine, in for Kathleen Dunn. We hope Kathleen feels better soon. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.